I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is my tocayo, Daniel Peña. We're talking to him all the way from Houston, where he teaches there at the University of Houston. We're going to talk about his new novel called Bang. And before we do, I wanted to talk about a little bit about how I choose the books that I want to talk about on the air. There are so many great books coming out every year. And it's really hard to sift through them because we only have so many Sundays, which is the day that we air, of course. And so I tend to just choose books that for some reason I know I'm going to love. And this book, Bang, I had never read it, but we have a mutual publisher. And I was doing a trip. I think I was going to San Antonio for the weekend. And every time I do a trip to do readings or lectures or something, I try not to bring a bunch of books because I know realistically I'm not going to read them all. I try to bring one book and dedicate myself that entire 3-4 days that I'm gone in the hotel, on the airplane, in cafes, underneath trees in a park, wherever, to read that one book. And recently I brought Bang with me. And I tell you, I just poured through the pages. It's a beautiful novel, and I'm really eager to talk a little bit about the writer because entering into the landscape of this novel, you do go to some incredibly dark spaces, but as dark as it gets, there's always this kind of beautiful human dignity in all of the characters that keeps you reading and keeps hope alive. So stick around, and we're going to talk to Daniel Peña about Bang. Daniel Peña is a Pushcart-winning writer and professor at the University of Houston downtown. His fiction has been widely published, appearing in such journals as Plowshares, The Rumpus, Kalaloo, and the Kenyon Review Online. Bang is his first novel. Daniel, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks for having me, man.
Hey, you know, this novel, Bang, that you just came out with, it's fantastic. But before we get to talk about it, or before we get to enter into some of its darkness, because it does tend to get a little dark here and there, beautifully so. First of all, who is this Daniel Peña? Who are you? Where did you come from? How did you fall into language? Tell us your story.
I mean, that's like the hardest question first. I grew up in Austin. I was born in El Paso. And my mom's from San Antonio by way of Matamoros. She was born there. And so I feel like I grew up in this like weird, like it was sort of like the People's Republic of Austin, but then with this sort of like family in San Antonio and then this connection into Tamaulipas, you know, that northern Mexico. And so that's where, like, a lot of the book takes place. But having sort of grown up with a lot of, I had a lot of uncles and stuff in, like, the Air Force and stuff. We're always around, like, planes, and we're always at air shows and stuff like that. So that's how sort of my fascination with aviation took hold. I became a pilot. I was a terrible pilot. Mm-hmm. And I learned that sort of during my years at Texas A&M, which was sort of like, it was a weird experience, like, especially coming from Austin, where, like, you know, it's such a progressive and sort of like UT-centric fabric, and I was there. And the thing that really saved me with this group of Mexicans, essentially, people who were coming over from Querétaro and Torreón and those regions who were studying engineering there, who got me into flight and sort of made this a kind of, I thought that was going to be my career path for the longest time. And then when the market fell out, you know, 2008, big market crash, sort of like my decision was made for me. It wasn't just like the American market. I mean, it had ripples across the world, but it was during this time, too, that And for different reasons, it was really sort of Mexicana Airlines had sort of like imploded, sort of like grift rather, in embezzlement. But I had an interview lined up there that never happened. And essentially what happened was I had this like pilot training. And I dreamed, I had sort of this thing to fly for Mexicana Airlines. And then,
really? Mexicana specifically?
Well, I had a buddy who was sort of like his dad was in the sort of valence of it, and he knew that his son was going to sort of like take his place. He's in the valence of it. He was a pilot at Mexicana. Mm-hmm. And he gave me this opportunity. He said, if you want to take my place when I retire, I can get you an interview.
Wow.
But then obviously the company imploded. And I remember it was Sherman Lexi who came to campus and said, you know, this is like the best problem to have. He's like, there's no jobs for you. Your first career just completely fizzled out. And during this time, I'd always been writing. And so he's like, you have nothing better to do but write. And so I just went full tilt into that. But just sort of, I knew then I sort of wanted to write a story about flight, but then about dignity and sort of, you know, the drug war. And kind of my own family's involvement with sort of the drug war, which is sort of like, not directly, but, you know, most people who grew up in the Northern Mexican Republic are sort of impacted by it.
Right, right. That's interesting that the answer to how you fell into language is intimately connected to your experience as a pilot. At what point did you just start to absorb yourself in writing so much so that now you are a professor of writing?
Yeah, really, it was almost like boring where it was like, I mean, I've always loved writing, you know, like I've always been a big reader and sort of like, and it was really, I had a couple of really good professors during my undergraduate years, one of which was Larry Heineman, who was telling me, if you really want to do this, you have to do this like, you know, full time and really dedicate yourself to it. And I applied to some MFAs and I got into like this, the MFA that I never thought I would get into my life. Like in a lot of ways, it was like, that was my only way out because it had
which
like
MFA?
Cornell.
Cornell.
So I studied with Elena Maria Viramontes and Ernesto Quiñones and they were my heroes at that time. And it was really through their guidance that I was able to sort of like develop a routine and, you know, like I think a lot of people tell young writers like, hey, just read a lot. That's a good education. And it's true. But even then, I was like, I don't even know what to read. Like when you're like 21, you're just like, I'll read it. And they're like, read the newspaper, read everything. I'm like, and you take that advice to heart, but it's so overwhelming, you know.
Yeah.
And that's where I really found my routine.
Well, you know, dipping into the narrative of your life here and there, I discovered that you were primarily thought of yourself as a short story writer. So how did a novel come out of that writing stories? And how did this novel specifically, Bang, come out?
Yeah. You know, George, like one of my favorite sort of pieces like of advice came from like George Saunders, who didn't tell this to me directly, but just I'd heard him say this once, where he said, you know, like a short story is like building a yurt. And, you know, if you can build a house out of like 1,000 yurts, it's a yurt house, but it's still a house.
What is a yurt?
You know, a yurt is like this sort of, I don't know, it was like sort of back to the earth 70s movement. Like people had these like sort of open, you know, these open houses outside, but it's like a tent and it's like has to be constantly heated because it's open, right? I'm doing a terrible job of explaining that. but he's like, it's sort of like, he's like, if you can build a house out of like 1,000 yurts, you know, or if you can build a house out of 1,000 tents, it's a tent house, but it's still a house, you know?
Yeah.
And so I knew that I was like, oh, if I could do like seven, I was thinking like if I could do like 7 length short stories and then just over a series of, no joke, like 15 drafts, it was just melding them and just sort of trying to make sure that, you know, they fit together and then you sort of mess with the sort of the mechanizations of it. And I tried my best. I did it really sort of in an inelegant way a long time. But that was how I sort of made the bridge from, you know, the short story to the novel. And it really was intentional. Like, I really wanted to see if I could write a novel.
You know, and in a sense, a great novel and a good novelist is one who can tell the entire story in such a way that if you take out a section from the novel and you read it, it should have some sort of self-containment, some sort of, you know, every section.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about this novel, Bang, that you just wrote, it's about a family, 3 people on the Texas side of the border illegally. And one of them, Cuauhtémoc, one of the brothers, knows how to fly a plane, and they go on this flight at night, and they land in Mexico, and oh man, the story is heartbreaking and beautiful. But you have these 3 characters, and then you have these 3 perspectives, and each part, each chapter in itself, is it somehow self-contained, yet it deepens the story. Did any of these sections or any of these characters start out as short stories?
Definitely. Like the first chapter, Flying Mexicans, was published in the Kenyon Review like way back. This was like in a nascent version of the novel.
Wow.
And then Safe Home. It was actually 2 short stories that I tried to Frankenstein together because I just had an intuition that there was some connective tissue there. And I failed at it. And it went through like 7 or 8 drafts. But those were the big nodes of the novels, like the first, and I think that's like the 10th chapter or something like that. And then from there, it was just like really bridging those, and I knew sort of the broad sketches of them. And then I think there was Night Flight, that chapter was a short story that I never sent out, but it was sort of its own standalone thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you made a really interesting statement that I think some of our listeners would appreciate if I repeat. You said you took 2 stories and Frankenstein together.
Yeah. You sort of like meld, you know, you sort of like try to piece them together and there's some connective tissue there, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, that's fantastic. So how did Bang come about? Was the inspiration for this particular novel?
Yeah. It's one of these things I'm a little hesitant to sort of like talk about, like, I'll just say it. It's like, you know, I think every family has been touched by the drug war in some way.
Absolutely. Especially if you live on the border like we do here, or like, you know, your characters.
Yeah, it was this thing that I was really thinking about, sort of the very catalyst of it was like this cousin I have that was essentially imprisoned in Mexico City for being a part of like a, kind of like a combo, like a gang kind of, you know. Mm-hmm. This is like, and my family's kind of soft, you know, so I was really surprised. I was like, well, we have a gang cousin? Well, yeah. But it was this thing where was like, they were coming after his family, and this is like 20 years later. This is like early 90s when he was incarcerated, right? For something to my family's, what they would say is that they're not sure if he did or did not do this thing. And this is like second, third cousin, but it's sort of this lore in our family. But it was fascinating that like, wow, even this guy, you know, this second or third cousin who I've never met, but I've met his sister and she's really sweet. But, you know, like the memory of like a crime syndicate or a combo or a gang is spanned over decades and generations. And so, you know, something that happened, you know, a gazillion years ago, they still harass the family for today.
Wow.
And so I was really fascinated by the roots of the novel were like that. What are like the seeds of the drug war as they manifest in sort of like the northern Mexican fabric, but then even into sort of like people who have nothing to do with the drug war? How do they touch lives? And you know, I looked at the latest statistics, something like 250,000 people killed between 2000 and, what was that, 2006 and today, which is like bananas. You know, that's when Calderon took office and then Peña after him. Now we're heading into AMLO, that presidency. But then, and then like 30,000 missing. You know, if you look at like the numbers on like Pinochet or, you know, the dirty war in Argentina, you know, those start superseding those numbers. And so I was like, wow,
that's amazing to think of it in that context.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that even though it touches a lot of families, there's sort of this hush-hush about like what exactly happened, family's involvement in it, et cetera. And so what I wanted to do was like, what happened, sort of the fundamental question of this, you know, how invested are we as a country, the United States, in fighting and ending a drug war in which we're actively deporting people to?
Right.
To then when they get absorbed into these, say, cartels or really they're like loose federation. We call them like as cartels if there's like this monolith, but it's like a federation of like cells, really.
Right.
And the way in which people find dignity within this fabric. And I think for me, that was fascinating. That was a story of this cousin, but it's also the story of like a lot of people were deported, but then a lot of people who just are under those circumstances. And it's really a specific segment of the population. It's not meant to sort of indict Mexico at large or something.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, when something happens to an entire community, it's going to be incredibly difficult to not find yourself connected to what happened by some degrees of separation.
Yeah.
I love that idea that, you know, your family, you know, what? We have a gang cousin?
Yeah. I think every family does.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
It has to. It's like here in El Paso, if you talk to the elders, almost every elder either has a Pancho Villa story or knew somebody who rode with Pancho Villa, great-grandmother who slept with Pancho Villa.
Yeah.
I mean,
everybody
has that connection, you know, because it was such an impactful time. And so I imagine right now, we all are very close to those. We all have a gang cousin somewhere.
Yeah, no, my family has a Pancho Villa story, but I imagine especially in El Paso because it's like, that was like the Visión del Norte. That was like right there in Ciudad Juárez, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
All the three battles of Juárez, and he was, that's fascinating.
Well, you know, it's a beautiful novel. We're talking about Bang, a novel by Daniel Peña, and it has two brothers, and they're flying in a plane at night, passing around a bottle of whiskey, and of course, whiskey flying at night probably doesn't mix well, and they end up crashing and getting separated. The one brother, Uli, I think he's the youngest brother, if I'm not mistaken, ends up in a hospital and sneaks out because he has money hidden in his sweats. And he takes a bus, goes to the town where his family came from in Mexico. And he probably hasn't been in Mexico for such a long time and doesn't feel very Mexican, but he manages to get to San Miguel. And the description of that city is so beautifully vivid and sad. I mean, there's boulders in the middle of the street so cars can't get in, and there's dilapidated houses, and just a dog isn't safe because it might get butchered. And I wanted to know where you got the model for that town, how that came to be in your imagination, because it certainly comes out as a very vivid place in the novel.
That's a great question. It came from the Juárez Valley, sort of just southeast of Ciudad Juárez, which is like those towns like Guadalupe and Praxis Guerrero, and I'm hoping I'm remembering those names right. But Melissa Del Bosque had done this great, incredible sort of piece for the Texas Observer. This must have been 2012, in which she really details sort of these entire towns that are sort of like, because of sort of the triangulation of the federal troops from Mexico and the army and Alto Defensas and cartels, and there's sort of the infighting between all of those people, some of these towns have been completely hollowed out. And so the ancestral home of Uli and Cuauhtémoc, the characters, it's a fictional San Miguel. The joke is that there are like seven San Miguels in Mexico, the most famous being San Miguel de Allende.
Right.
But this is sort of like...
I love that when the cab driver, I think, asks him, are you sure this is the right San Miguel?
And he's like, dang, yeah. I mean, that's happened to me before in Mexico, too, where like you think you're going to one, you know, like there's like, I'm trying to think, there's one town where I remember I took a bus to, but it was like totally in the opposite end of the country kind of thing. And I was like 19. I was like, oh, my God. But it's just one of these things where he gets to the right San Miguel, but he goes there because he's expecting to find his father who was deported. And he's like, okay, we're going to regroup here. This is where we're from, and we're going to be able to do this. And so, and reunite. And he realizes that, like, nobody's there. His home is there, but June, who's a squatter in the house, is essentially sort of his psychopomp, right? She's the person who guides him through the new rules of this new city.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to go a little deeper into when he gets into his father's house. And you can't help but, when you write as well as you do, Daniel, you can't prevent the reader from reading and creating a metaphorical landscape or understanding your metaphorical landscape and deepening it with their own experience. But that entering into that house was such an incredible landscape. You could look around at the things on the walls and at the furniture and read so much into it. But one of the things that he finds in that house is a young woman. And I want to read a little bit because you already revealed her name is June.
Yeah.
But here's how we first meet her. Her face is a patchwork of pink and white and gray. The left side of her face is like a sheet of rice paper, a shiny blister that's never healed. She's missing part of her nose and part of her ear, too. One of the first things I think that occurred to me as I was reading this is how it completely rejects any kind of attempt to exoticize these victims and to turn her into a sexual or an object of desire. But immediately it shows her in, you know, that's the first image we get of her. And because the reader is going to consider metaphor and allegory, I'm wondering what you thought about June in terms of how she might be interpreted and any kind of manipulation of the language or twisting of the language is probably a better way of saying it, that allowed her meaning to deepen.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, June is like one of my favorite characters.
Mine too. I love her.
Yeah, she's totally based on these kids who are in Mexico City, where I lived for a little bit, who are in these sort of like these combos, like these little street gangs. They're not like full-fledged gangs, and it's not like necessarily violent, but it's like a gang out of survival. But they're also squatters. Like Mexico, I'm not sure if it's just Mexico City, but I have it in place in this city in which there's this great law that, you know, to avoid a place becoming something like New York City or London in which people can never afford rent, they have these squatter laws in which if squatters are able to sort of lay claim to a place for more than, I want to say, 60 days, they own that space.
Wow.
So say an investor from, you know, Southeast Asia or from Europe decides they want to buy an apartment in Mexico City and they just want to use it as, you know, as an investment property. They're never going to live there and it jacks the rate, the cost of living up for everyone else around them. A squatter could, in theory, go in there and lay claim to it and then own it.
Right.
And so June is one of these people in which she uses sort of those systems. She squats throughout all of these vacant properties in the neighborhood. And she's really just sort of this metaphor for, you know, this like incredible grit, this incredible survival. But also I'm trying to sort of deconstruct the sort of like, you know, her sister was one of these people who was one of the statistics of the femicides, the famous femicides in Ciudad Juarez. And everyone was obsessed with her virginity and with, you know, her purity. And there was this sort of weird obsession with June's sister. And June is sort of like breaking this down in that she is, you know, through circumstances, like she was a bookie for like a dog fight. She was involved in dog fighting in this city. She was burned because, you know, people thought she had like superpowers or something. She was like
right,
kind of like a witch, you know.
Yeah, that's a great scene.
she was this, she's essentially just this, at once she's almost like a half victim of femicide, but is totally like a full victim of as well. But, you know, the scars in her body are scars of misogyny, right? But also the way in which she moves throughout, she's almost like proud of these scars, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
like
she
wears them, they're like battle scars, but that nothing kills her.
And you know what's really interesting is I think that there are going to be some readers that are going to give her kind of a Virgil-like metaphorical quality, because it really is because of her that he is able to walk through and negotiate this just incredibly horrible place.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what happens to her at the end, and I won't reveal it because I think people should read the last chapter on their own. It just blew me away. But what happens to her at the end is, in essence, a crossover for Uli in terms of, you know, how she became kind of a guide and then what he ended up doing with that guide and where that brought him afterwards. But yeah, that, I'm sorry, I might be going
too
metaphorically into the text, but it's
no,
that's
totally
that.
That you're a really close reader. I actually really appreciate that. I mean, this is what, to the end of the not to like spoil the ending of the book, but like sort of like, you know, in the way the femicides have been written about, there is a kind of violence in which Uli, I don't know, perpetrates on June. And it's sort of, Uli wouldn't see himself as necessarily a violent guy, but it's a way in which even in innocuous or seemingly innocuous situations, you can still perpetrate that violence and it can end in disaster.
Yeah, and I'm talking to Daniel Pena, author of a novel called Bang. And I was thinking about the beginning of the novel, the Araceli chapter. She's the mother, and I love her character, the fact that she's a very complex character right from the beginning. She can fix radios. She can, you know, manipulate a lot of things with her hands.
Yeah.
But the brother, one of the brother's birthday, I think it's Uli's birthday, if I'm not mistaken. And then Cuauhtémoc, the older brother, who is a pilot, does dust cropping, comes home with a puppy. And he gives the puppy to his little brother as a gift. And, you know, the mother resists. But it's such a cute little puppy.
Yeah.
And then that's that, you know, we kind of open with that innocent little cute puppy. And then we end with a much different view of dogs. And and I'm wondering if you consciously, not framed, but anchored the novel within that imagery. And even if you didn't, I'm sure you were aware of it and must have played with it a bit in order to create some sort of effect.
No, totally. I think one of the things, I think constantly of dogs as like psychopomps of, like, you know, like Virgil-like characters, like of any landscape, right? They're more familiar with the city than any foreigner or any sort of outsider of any city coming into it could imagine, right? And they sort of like, but, you know, I forget where, which myth it was, but the idea of like dogs as the guide to sort of the underworld.
The guards, the guards of the underworld, absolutely.
Yeah.
And towards the end, that last scene is just devastating, and there's dogs throughout.
Everywhere, yeah. No, and just the idea of like flesh, right? There was this one taqueria I used to eat at in Mexico City that, that it came out later in the news. It wasn't dogs, it was cats. But this idea of just like that people were sort of like meat as a commodity or meat as something that sort of organically might come from the streets, and sort of the meat grinder. I was really obsessed with that imagery. And, you know, it comes up again and again and again through the dog fights or through like that last scene. But I'm fascinated by that as sort of really in dog primarily as a kind of like psychopomp.
You know, and I'm going to tell the readers right now that one of the best characters in this novel is a dog named Atomica.
Yeah.
And he is a tough guy. He's tough, yet very loyal to June, incredibly loyal to June. That very touching scene at the end when they have to say goodbye is quite beautiful. I think we're running out of time, but maybe I could just ask you one real quick question.
Sure.
I read, I think in the afterwards, in the acknowledgement, you make this statement that writing a novel is a mystical undertaking. Can you, unfortunately, very briefly comment on that?
Yeah. I mean, it feels like you never know what's coming next, even if you can have sort of be an architect of your own sort of plot or imagination. I feel like weirdly serendipitous things happen and books come to you at the right time and teachers come to you at the right time. And it can be a really bewildering but beautiful endeavor. And it's mystical, I think.
That's a beautiful answer. Thank you. Daniel Pena, the novel is Bang. Daniel, thank you for joining me on Words.
Thank you
on
so much, man.
I'd like to thank my guest, Daniel Pena, for joining me on Words on a Wire. The name of the novel is Bang, and it is available, well, these days you can get books pretty much anywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, go to your local bookstore. I even hear 7-Eleven now has a large selection of books. No, that's not true. I'm just kidding. I'd like to thank our producer, Stefania Castro, the greatest producer in the world. And thank you for joining us. And we'll see you next time on Words on a Wire.